Welcome to What If, a space to talk about education for growth, innovation that generates change, community, and a lifestyle that deserves to be shared. Welcome to What If. Hello, everybody. How are you guys? Well, today is a great day. Friday here, Mexico City. Saturday in the amazing country where a great friend lives. Tom, here you are. Let me invite you. There you are. An amazing topic we are really passionate about, something that it's very interesting for ophthalmologists and any other discipline, I think, in the world. Amazing book. I hope this is the first of many, many episodes with the great Tom Campbell. Here it is. Let's see if you can join me. Completely different parts of the world, right? Completely different extremes. I sent you an invite. Hope you can join. And we're going to talk about an amazing book. For those who are joining, today is going to be in English. It's going to be backwards, but it's going to be this book. It has an amazing story. This book was recommended by an amazing friend, that it's Alejandra, an amazing friend and colleague. You know, she invited me. She told me that I must read that book. There is some problems with Tom connecting. Maybe you need to update the app. Let's try it again. But well, I'm going to do the introduction. So basically, it's a book that in the moment I told Tom about the book, he said, oh man, we need to talk about it. We met with him a couple of years ago in the amazing, let's try again, Tom. I don't know what's happening. Maybe we live such in different, you know, in different latitudes that Instagram doesn't want to work. Let's hope you get the invite. And so basically when I told Tom about this book, he was so excited about it. He read it and he wants to talk about it. Let's, again, for those who are there, Black Box Thinking. It starts with an amazing analogy about healthcare and about aviation, something we're doing a lot because we have the, you know, the opportunity to train colleagues with simulators. So we are very excited about that. Let's try again, Tom, here. Let's see if I can make it happen. I'm so excited to talk to you. There you go. How are you, man?
Hey, Ivo, thanks a lot for having me.
No, it's a pleasure, such a pleasure. And especially I was talking about, you know, talking in completely different dimensions, right? Different parts
exactly.
of the world. You live in the
yep.
future, I live in the past.
Something like exactly that. Right. That's exactly right. 12 hours ahead, is that right? 10 hours ahead.
Yes. Yeah, I think it's more than 12 hours, so it's very interesting, right?
Yeah, the future's great.
So, well, I was telling, you know, the colleagues and people that we met 3-4 years ago in Melbourne in an amazing course that a colleague from us did, Jean I, Jacqueline Belts, amazing colleague. So we met, we just clicked with different concepts. Then we had the chance to be in the refractive course a couple of weeks ago. And the moment I mentioned you this book, you read it, you loved it, I said, let's do it. Let's start talking about it, right?
Exactly. And this book is a real favorite of mine. And in fact, it was recommended to me first by my brother-in-law, and he's a pilot. And he,
wow.
Yeah, and he's actually responsible for training. So he does the training for one of the big airlines in Europe. And so he and I obviously have lots of discussions around the differences in attitudes towards failure, difference in attitudes towards training between the aviation industry and healthcare. And it's something that obviously we're both really passionate about. But it's something that this book really explores in fantastic detail. And anyone who hasn't read it, like, I strongly recommend you read it. And I mean, I suppose you might ask, why haven't we just told you go and read the book, and why are we discussing it? And I think the important reason about why we need to discuss it together is because we need to contextualize the learnings from this book in a domain-specific way. So for you and I, that's about cataract surgery. That's about ophthalmic education. That's about how we run, you know, safe, precise, high-quality patient-centered clinics. And so what I really want to hear is, you know, your perspective, what learnings you took away from it. And obviously, it's a huge book with a lot of things in it. And it's, I think that potentially maybe we'll just discuss the first couple of chapters and we can come back and go over it again in another. Yeah,
man, that's what we were talking about. I mean, we wanted to discuss the entire book, and in the first three chapters, there's so many things that we can learn from, because it's a completely different perspective of what we do. Don't you agree? For those who are joining, it's going to be backwards. Actually, Raul, that is a great colleague from us from Australia, was here. I hope you're there, Raul. Hi to you from Mexico. And I'm pretty sure you're going to love this book. It's going to be backwards, but it's Black Box Thinking from this author, Matthew Sied. It actually has many other interesting books as well.
Yeah.
But let's start with this one. And why the black box, right? I think that's the first. Let's have a definition of the book that I think it's amazing. Only by this definition, we can talk like 45 minutes, because it has so many interesting. Oh, how are you, Raul? Yeah, he's there saying
Bounty's,
hi.
Bounty's also
great. We're so glad to have you. We're so glad that actually technology allows us, you know, to be in touch. We had such an amazing course a couple of years ago, and to be with you, Raul, it's great to have you. Let's define that. Black box thinking is the willingness and tenacity to investigate the lessons that often exist when we fail, but which we rarely exploit. Very interesting. And that is, you know, we can add that it's about creating systems and cultures. I think those are very interesting words we need to talk about, Tom, to enable organizations to learn from errors rather than being threatened by them. I think that's, with that definition, it's so, so important, not only for our specific skills we need to master, but for everybody, right? So let's really talk about failure. Let's really learn from failure.
Exactly. And I think that, you know, the single greatest obstacle to progression is failing to get evidence about our failures. And so, you know, part of it is that we are so afraid of failure that we don't want to even know if we are failing a lot of the time. And this
actually,
whole book is,
let me add that the book says that we have a system to delete failure from our memory. That's, oh my God, keep going, but
no,
that's
exactly
so important.
And the you know, because especially in systems like healthcare, where the whole thing is predicated on our learning and our expertise, we view failure as a moral failure, as an individual failure, as a problem with us. And so because we all think that we've studied hard and we've worked hard, the cognitive dissonance that comes about when we experience failure, it doesn't gel with our conception of ourselves. And so what we do is we pretend it's not failure. We rationalize it. We say it's one of those things. It didn't really happen. You know, it was just bad luck. Or, you know, we come up with these ex post fact explanations about why it wasn't a failure, instead of openly embracing it and saying, this is a signal telling me that there is some kind of error in either my processes, the system in which I'm working, or my thinking.
Wow. I can't agree with you more. And I think we're going to go to specific details. I would like to add to that the divergence between what you said, right? Pilots and airplane industry and healthcare. It's the approach to failure. It's completely different. And that is why, I'm sorry, guys, but I'm going to say it, and there is evidence about this. There is evidence that there is like two 747s crashing every day due to medical errors only in the United States. And that's huge. I'm thinking that's something we need to talk about. It's not only about medical errors, about diagnosis and treatment, but sometimes in the system, you know, prescribing a different drug that it was, you know, indicated by the doctor, about different examinations, you know, given to different patients. So I think it's a huge, you know, thing to give it the importance that it has, right? The approach to failure can be a very important opportunity, right? It is the willingness to learn from failure.
Yeah, and I think all paths to success lead through failure. I mean, you have to go through failure to get to success, and yet we view it as such an abhorrent process in medicine, is that we, and that reflects the blame culture kind of mindset that we have in medicine. And I think it's a really interesting distinction to be made between aviation, where there are mandatory reporting requirements that even if you have a near miss, you have to make a report. Those reports are immediately fed into a system that goes back to all the different airlines, and you have liability. So they waive liability if you make a report within 7 days of an event happening. And that's completely different mindset to what happens in medicine. And I think, you know, that's really highlighted in the book really well, where he talks about both Virginia Mason Hospital and Amy Edmondson's studies of the two not named hospitals. But so Virginia Mason Hospital in Seattle set up a reporting system, you know, modeled on what happens in aviation. And what they found was they got no incident reports. No one reported anything to begin with. Wow. And it's because people in healthcare aren't convinced that the reason these things are set up is to improve systems, because they think that it is just going to be used for blaming doctors, or it's just a box ticking exercise, because we don't have that idea that we are embracing failure. We're embracing near misses. We want to learn, we want to improve systems, because that's not our lived day-to-day experience in hospitals. But once the hospital was able to explain to people and demonstrate that this was about improving systems and not blaming individuals, they had this incredible uptake and people started reporting all kinds of things. And people feel that when you report an error or report a near miss, that patients are going to be upset or the hospital is going to be upset. But in fact, it vastly reduced the litigation against the hospital, because they were able to A, openly disclose things to people, but also prevent error going forward.
Completely agree. I'm going to do a quick exercise. This is the book, sorry, because it's going to be backwards, but I just want you to see that I'm going to just, you know, talk about only the titles of the chapters, and then we're going to focus in chapter one, because only with chapter one we can talk for 3 or 4 hours. Chapter one is talking about the logic of failure. That is what we're going to talk about. Then you already talk about cognitive dissonance. That it's fine that many people don't understand that concept or are not familiar with that, because we need to talk a lot about that concept. Then something that is very interesting for us, especially, right, as cataract surgeons, is like confronting complexity, because we are always in a complex environment, and that's not easy, right? Small steps and giant leaps, imagine about that. That's amazing, you know, just how you can, by small steps, can do huge advances. The blame game, you talk about that, right, Tom? It's who I can blame. So I don't feel that bad. You know, I'm in a very high risk, job. So I try to blame somebody else because I just can't handle blame. Or think about it. You know, a doctor saying to the patient, oh, yeah, sorry, it was my mistake. Oh, because we're also patients. Imagine that the doctor says something like that to you. How are you going to feel? It's not easy to face failure as a doctor, right? And then the last chapter is creating a growth culture. Amazing. Especially a growth mindset is something that we really need to fight every single day, I think, right? So let's go to just chapter number one. Think about this. It has a routine operation example. Very interesting example, since I'm the son of an anesthesiologist, and it's all about the second thing is about one airplane flight that was like United Airlines 173. Interesting story, and how we can learn a lot from that. And then the paradox of success. I don't know. I think we should focus today in that logic of failure. And I don't know if you remember the example of the routine operation or what happened there.
Yeah, it's a really sad story. And the gentleman, the husband of the woman who was the person who suffered in it, is called Martin Brommelin. He's a pilot, and he's actually still out there working. My brother-in-law has met him and had discussions with him, and something we're talking about. And his wife went in for a routine operation, and they got into a can't intubate, can't oxygenate situation, and they became fixated on essentially trying to intubate her, and lost track of time, and then she suffered a hypoxic brain injury. Yeah.
Nice.
The comparison is with this airline flight, 173, which is flying into Portland, I believe, and an error signal comes up on their dashboard, and they become fixated on the dashboard, and they're discussing what's happening with that, and then they lose track of time, and in their case, they lose track of fuel, and essentially they have the exact same thing. They run out of fuel and come out of the sky and suffer a catastrophic crash. But it's really the difference in the approach to these two events, which are exactly the same. You know, it's about the limitations of focus. It's about human error in really complex dynamic situations.
Exactly.
But instead of approaching...
Let me add another thing, that it was communication between the team.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it was hierarchy, and there is something very interesting in both examples. Very simple. Example number one, you know, they have a young patient. They try to intubate her, and they just can't do it, and they're fixating in that. But the nurse, you know, prepares everything for a tracheostomy. And she says, you know, she implies somebody to do a tracheostomy, but she doesn't do it in a way the doctors hear her.
Yeah. She brings the tray in and puts the tray on the table, but no one notices. Oh, yeah.
And it's interesting how, especially in the airplane 173, the decision making. I mean, the pilot knows that, you know, he has a light that says the training gear is not down, so you know they don't have the. You stated that correctly in English.
Essentially the landing gear. The landing gear. Has failed. So they don't know if it's down or not.
So they don't know, but listen to this one. He knows at all times that he can land without, I mean, it's dangerous, but nobody will get hurt. Or at least in many, many cases, nobody will get hurt. But he, as you said, he's fixated in that. So I think we need to talk about focus. But focus when things are not going as the way you want them to be, right? Because when everything goes fine, everybody's happy, you know, you're making jokes in the operating room and listen to music. But what happens when things don't go the way you want to go? Because there is when you see the true, actually, the true high performance in every single situation, right? But I only wanted to add to your amazing description about the communication, because then the pilot is fixating in the gear, but the number two is saying, we are not going to make it to the airport. He says it two or three times, but the pilot is not listening. So there is no a system for them to communicate. And I think there, as we saw in the, right, in the definition, it's so important, not only in surgery, but in medicine and in ophthalmology as well. Don't you agree?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And, you know, Martin Brommelin, he comes in, his wife has suffered this terrible event, and the surgeon comes up to him and puts his arm around him and says, I'm sorry, it was just one of those things.
It's one of, and one of, right?
One of those things. And that's the end. That's the end of the exploration of failure. That was the end of them trying to look into why this happened. It was just one of those things. And you can forget it and move on from there. But in the airline industry, the plane has crashed, And one of the first things that happens is that the National Transport Board, sends out a crash investigation team. They're on the plane within the hour of the plane crashing. So they're out to go and investigate what's happened. And they do this long and detailed investigation. They discuss all the different aspects, including the communication aspects. And within a couple of weeks of the crash, they have come out with recommendations about, systems level performance, communication training that is fed back into the training programs of each of the airlines. This is in the medical industry, it's one of those things, and even their colleagues, even people in the tea room, might not learn about what has happened in this theater. It's just one of those things. And this is what Matthew Tsai is really trying to get at. That's the black box that we need in medicine. That's the black box that we need in other industries, which is the information about failure that we can then go back on, investigate, and then with an open loop kind of thinking, improve upon
Oh,
our performance.
another. Oh, you said many interesting things. Let me keep that keep that in mind, the open loop system. But something extra, black boxes are not black anymore. They're kind of orange because everyone's, he makes fun of that. You need to see it in a complex, when they fall. But something I would really like to add there, Tom, I agree 100%, is that they have two black boxes. One is for everything that's happening in the plane, but listen to the second one, is to talk about the communication of the people involved. Why? They want to be inside the minds of people doing that, make the decision making. And I believe that's so powerful because, when you look at events after it passed, at least, us as surgeons, we are looking, in the video, in the Congress, in the meeting, and said, oh, I will do it so different. I'm such a good surgeon, blah, blah, blah. But when you're there, that's what matters. When you're there making decisions with the pressure, with the anesthesiology around, with so many things in your head. So I believe that that's very important, to analyze what happens. Not only, in the external things, but in the mind of the people, because this comes to people making decision in a very complex and high stress situation and environment. And I think that's where we need to learn a lot. But let's talk about, because I agree with you.
Ivo, I
Let's
want to
talk
go back
about,
about the
yes.
human factors element is so important in surgery, and it's something that we talk about so rarely. And our simulations and our training, we never talk about the human factors elements of what it means to be in a theater working within a team of people who are influencing your performance and you're influencing their performance.
Let me, before I forget, sorry, before I forget, because we don't do this, we call it different in this part of the world, but you say theater. And it's very interesting why we call an operating room a theater in so many parts of the. Just let put that in, all right?
Exactly. We're
The
actors
future,
upon a
right? Okay,
stage.
keep going with that. Keep going.
And I always try to tell people, trainees, is that the surgeon in the room is an amplifier. So whatever emotions you're feeling, the scrub nurse, the anesthetist, they're feeling your emotion, but amplified three times more. So if
Nice.
you're stressed, everyone around you is way more stressed than you are.
Wow,
And
that's a good one. That's a good one, man.
no one gets better under stress. So you know that the more difficulty you're in an operation, the slower you are handed instruments. And they're always handing you the wrong instruments. And that's because you're stressed and you're making the team around you stressed. And so they're
Nice.
having more difficulty in giving you the kind of things that you need. And so I think that we, this is an area that we need to think about and we need to integrate into our training and our simulation. So even, with fantastic simulators like the IC, it's all about us interacting with an eye. It's not about us interacting with the other human beings in a room. And at the end of the day, as both of these cases show, it's that communication and the systems level error that get us into trouble. You rarely have a terrible case in surgery that happens because of one mistake. It's always a cascade of mistakes. Now, if you blow out a capsule, that's fine. You go in, you do an anterior vitrectomy, but it's when you blow out a capsule and then they don't give you the visco fast enough and then you depressurize the eye. It's always a cascade, and that cascade is almost always about your interaction with the people around you.
I really love that. I never heard that concept, and I really like it. If you are stressed, you just, you know, give that to your entire ecosystem, right? They're more stressed than you. Amazing. We're talking now about the situation itself. What's happening in that moment? And, you know, there's something very important that the book says, and I want to talk about you, that it's attention. It turns out a scarce resource. If you focus on one thing, you will lose awareness of other things. And I believe that's very important in both cases, especially on what you said. You're not only focusing on only one thing and forget about everything else, but the other problem is the time. You forget about time. So there's a lot of research about people when they have a complex problem-solving situation, they lose track of time. And that's very important in what we do, right?
Well, the pilot in Flight 173, he tells the investigator from his hospital bed, he said, we ran out of fuel so fast, I think there must have been a fuel leak, right? Because he couldn't imagine that there was a world where he was so focused that there was just, you know, time flew past and that he just burnt all the fuel in the air. And so he was convinced that there must have been a second problem, not just the fact that he focused in so close that he was unable to work out what's happening around him. Now, in terms of cataract surgery, we see this all the time. We're dealing with a tiny field at the best of times, right? But when you watch junior surgeons operating, you see that they're only concentrating on the sort of 2 millimeters around the end of their instrument. And so even though it's only, you know, 11 millimeters across from white to white, you can see that they don't know what's happening with their other hand. Their other hand is leaning on the eye. The second instrument's wandering around because as they get more and more stressed, their focus comes on a smaller and smaller part of the eye. Exactly. And you know, you see that they're grabbing the edge of the rexus, and where it's tearing is running out, but they're looking at the end of their forceps. They're not looking at the rest of it. And it's, you know, those kinds of, that's the cataract surgery example of this hyper focus, which is actually making your performance worse in these situations. Now, this is great. Rahul just made a comment here about that they're trying, and Rahul's obviously really important in the simulation training scheme within Australia and New Zealand. And they're trying to work to make the OR environment as realistic as possible in their simulations. So they've got a colleague around them where they have to ask for instruments and recording your behavioral management. So that's fantastic. That's excellent, Rahul. Thanks, mate.
Yes, no, and he's very smart, and he's, you know, in this, and that's going to be the next topic, Rahul. Wait for it, because I have a couple of very interesting things about how pilots and airplane industry use simulators a lot. And the three of us here, Tom, me, and you, Raul, we love simulators to teach, but there is a lot of people they own simulators that they don't believe in this technology to train us. But let's talk about a little bit, you know, later. So again, focus could be good, but then it could be bad because you lose awareness of everything around that. And the second thing is you lose track of time.
So the other thing is that we care so much about sentinel events, right? Is someone dies in anesthesia, someone dies in surgery, or a plane crashes out of the sky. But they're not the only data points that we should be assaying. You know, near misses are just as important for learning as an actual event. But the airline industry collects all this information, but we do it so poorly in medicine. I mean, we don't even collect a lot of the information about complications in surgery well. And so one of the things that I always say is that you've got to maximize the feedback that you're getting from the world around you. You need to maximize the learning opportunities that the world is trying to tell you. You need to collect as much information about your failures as possible. Just to go back to the Rexus component, right? Just because you didn't run the Rexus out doesn't mean you're not doing a poor Rexus, right? So sure, you managed to get it around. That is, if it started to run out, that's a near-miss event that you should think about why that started to happen. And you should spend as much time thinking about the antecedent events that led to the beginning of the run out as you would spend on a radialized Rexus with a dropped nucleus. But we don't do that. We go, oh, I saved it, and we're fine.
Exactly. No, and even I remember a dialogue between other colleagues making a joke because we were certifying our center sometime. And they ask you to report even when you were about to make a mistake. Because that's very important, because you say, okay, if everybody is about to make a mistake in this specific moment, we need to do something about it to prevent it. But then, again, our mindset, you know, sometimes doesn't go that way. I agree 100%. We should record everything. And there is another thing you said important is about feedback. And the book said and it's demonstrated that feedback that is given in a short period is more important than feedback given, you know, like 2 months after. So the feedback should be very in short in time when something happens, right?
Yeah. So there's another great book we'll discuss called The Disciplines of Execution. But in it, it says you should act on lead measures, right? Don't wait till the complications happened and 3 months down the track, it's kind of eventuated, because that's not giving you feedback on your immediate performance. So a lead measure in cataract surgery, for example, is your CDE, how much energy you've dumped inside the eye. Now, you could wait till the person's decompensated their cornea, you've given them a couple of months of high-dose steroids, and then they need their DSEC, and that could be your feedback. But instead, you should be looking at the CDE as a lead measure of how much energy you're putting inside an eye. And that will allow you to change your surgery in real time, sort of straight after the surgery, to say, why am I putting in a CDE of 40 into this eye, not waiting for 3 months when they need a graft? And our systems are set up so that you often don't get feedback on your surgery a lot of the time.
That's so important. Let me quote that because I found it in the book. It's right here. And it will give us to another amazing book that I'm pretty sure you've already read and we should discuss with many other colleagues, that is feedback when delayed is considerably less effective, improving intuitive judgment. Amazing. Now, we're talking about the two brains, and probably you are very familiar with the amazing book Think Fast and Slow from Daniel Kahneman. So, you know, we are citing one of the most amazing books with a Nobel Prize award. But again, feedback should be, you know, not delayed. I think that's very important. So to just go to the final part of this conversation and then talk about simulation where Raul was talking about, let's go to look at this, these two quotes that I have. Only by redefining failure will we unleash progress, creativity, and resilience. Wow. I think that's something to take away and to put in your, you know, into your wall and the operating room every single day, because it's very important. And you said it, and I want to repeat it again. The problem is not about the consequences of failure. The problem is about the attitude towards failure. So that's what we need to change in the third part of the first. We're talking about the first chapter, guys. I mean, you know, I think, Tom, we need to do this every Friday or Saturday for you, you know, because this is incredible. But this one is going to be very important because of something. It's going to be called the paradox of success. Okay? Very interesting. Why success should be a paradox, right? Why is not success straightforward? And it's like, oh, it's so easy to be successful. Guess what? The guys who are really successful, they have a different approach about failure. And that approach has to do, you know, and I'm going to show it. Sorry, guys, because I'm very excited with this. Probably everybody understands, but look at that. we are seeing Karl Popper talking about science, guys. So the success of science is exactly that approach to failure, not being afraid to fail and to correct it and move on. As simple as that. So why that we are really scientists in medicine, can we have that attitude, Tom?
It's great. It's a fantastic point. It doesn't matter how many times you're right, you never demonstrate that a theory is correct by being right more times. It matters how many times it's wrong. And science is completely predicated on this notion, the falsification of hypothesis, right? And that's the path to success. I mean, science has changed the world we're living in. You're in Mexico, yeah. I'm in Melbourne, and we're having an Instagram live conversation on using devices that have been made by science on Wi-Fi, created by science. The world science has changed dramatically because of science. And it's all predicated on the notion that you try to falsify what you cherish most, your theory. And that's how a scientific experiment is set up. You say, here is what I believe. How can I prove it wrong? But as we get successful, we invest in the success because it means that we are good people because we're successful people. And so we never want to be proven wrong. So we spend our life trying to demonstrate that we are right, not prove that we are false. And that is the exact wrong attitude. And part of it becomes that as we believe in ourselves more and we think that we're more successful, we start to avoid feedback because we don't want ever to be shown that we're false, because that would mean that because we've internalized, you know, our association with our hypotheses or with our theories or with our standing as a surgeon. And so we don't want to know about it. And so we avoid feedback. And we avoid feedback often by setting poor goals, right? And that's something that I often talk to junior surgeons about. They say, I want to be a better surgeon. And I say, well, that's a crappy goal, right? Because
I love it.
How would you falsify that? And it's really difficult. You can always say, oh, I'm doing pretty well, but what you want are goals that you can falsify today. You want them to be specific, measurable, achievable, realistic, and timely, right? Smart goals. So I say a better goal is, you want to be a better surgeon? Today, say, I'm going to do a list where every single rexus is 5.5 millimeters and perfectly circular. And we'll measure them. We can sit down and measure each one, and we can adjudicate on their circularness. Now, that is a goal that you can falsify in real time. And it'll turn out that actually a lot of our rexuses aren't 5.5 millimeters. You know, they're 5, or they're 5.75 or 6. And until you start measuring them and comparing them to a perfect circle, you aren't going to improve your technique, because you go, oh, it's good enough. And as you get better as a surgeon, you can't do anything through any size rexus. But you want to really get that feedback. And the way to get good feedback is to set up good goals that you can falsify in real time.
I can't agree with you more. And I'm going to show one of the last quotes. Sorry, guys, I'm doing it. I know it's backwards, but I want you to understand that this is in the book and it's highlighted for me. And we should read it every day, that failure, it's hardwired into both the logic, listen to this one, the logic and the spirit of scientific progress, period. So we need to talk about failure. We need to, you know, face it. We need to learn from it. And we need, especially the last concept that I wanted to talk about before we go to simulation, that it's, and he started talking about Toyota and a huge institution, a healthcare institution, learned a lot from Toyota. Why? Because of the attitude to failure, but also the systems they have to understand failure and learn from failure. I think, you know, that was like the last thing I wanted to do before I go to simulation, because that's an amazing passion we also shared, right, Tom?
But exactly.
I don't know if you have any comments on that concept.
No, I think getting onto simulation, the sooner the better.
Okay, so let's go to two other amazing quotes of the book, because after we talk about a very complex, you know, very complex environment and everything that happens, he also talks about how we can, let's take it. First, something we all know, Eleanor Roosevelt said, look at this one. Let's learn from mistakes from others. You know, you cannot live long enough to make them all yourself. That's something very interesting. And that's something that, you know, can happen in a simulated environment. So you can learn from the failure of others. And listen about these two quotes. I'm pretty sure you're going to like them. Is practice is about harnessing the benefits of learning from failure while reducing costs. Very interesting, right? And look at the second. Learning from failure, practice is not a substitute for learning from real-world failure. It is complementary to it, okay? But I think it's very interesting too. So what are we doing with Tom, with Raul, and with many other colleagues around the world is trying to learn from all those concepts from the airplane industry and bring them to the training of a surgeon, that it's a high performance in microsurgery, that it's in a very complex environment and needs to make a lot of decisions with a, you know, it can have a high consequence for the patient.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I think the idea of the complementarity of real world practice and simulation is something that we don't do really well in medicine. So part of the feedback loop of the reporting of error and near misses in aviation is that those events are then placed into the simulator. So my brother-in-law runs the simulation training for one of the big airlines, and he can get an event will happen and they'll have loaded up into the simulator within a couple of days. And then their training pilots can all fly those events, learn about how best to approach it, and then they get all their pilots through and they can all experience a similar event themselves. So that is a mechanism where real world events then feed into the simulation, which allows you to learn about flying better in the real world. We think of simulation a lot of the time as being only for first year residents, is that they can get on a simulator before they get into an eye. And sure, that's one useful thing for simulation,
exactly.
But it's probably it's probably one of the least powerful things that you can do with simulation. What would be fantastic is you have a bad event in Mexico and you tell us about it, and then I get to practice it on your simulator in Australia. So if that ever happens to me, I've already practiced it and I know what's going to happen, and I've learned from your mistakes without ever having to have it happen myself, like Eleanor Roosevelt said. And
you know, we have some amazing, amazing comments from Billy Craig. I don't know if you had
Will
a chance
Mitchell.
To read it, but very interesting, very interesting.
So good. And that's part of that hierarchy of communication poorly done in a lot of medicine and previously inside the airline industry. But so in fact, it was that 173 crash that led them to come up with the PACE acronym, you know, probe, ask, challenge, escalate. And that's something that's taught now, actually, even in medicine, it's just beginning to be introduced, even though this airline industry has been on it for years. And I think that's great that seniority doesn't equal infallibility. And I tell my scrub nurses all the time that if you think I'm making a mistake, tell me, right? I will never, ever, ever be upset if you're wrong, right?
Well,
if you bring in the tracheostomy tray and I don't need it, I'm never going to be upset with you. I will always be happy that you have told me and saved me from a potential catastrophe.
Well,
and that's something that
that's
it requires
nice. That's a
yeah, and it requires a lot of work because people will say things and you have to think about why they've said that, and often it's frustrating where you're like, no, I don't need that at the moment. But you realize that if you snap or if you shut them down or if you don't treat it properly, the time that they are going to save you from catastrophe, they're not going to speak up. And they are literally the people who are going to save you from a disaster. And so it's really important to kind of institute that culture and really reward people even if they've got it wrong. even if they give you the wrong instrument because they or tell you that you need to do a tracheostomy at that point and you don't, you still have to reward that behavior because that one time in a million, they will save you from a terrible career life-ending kind of disaster.
Very good one. But I interrupted you. You were talking about the power of simulation, not only for beginners, but for other
but for experts. Imagine that. If I make a mistake and it's immediately fed into the simulator and everyone else gets to experience the same thing and train on that unexpected event that happened to me and I had to do it in someone's eye, but you get to have that unexpected event in a simulator. That's the future, I think, of education and this idea of a community of practice that we're all actually attached to each other, and there's no reason why our knowledge and our experiences shouldn't be flowing sideways. It shouldn't be siloed within, you know, at each institution. We should all be discussing this at a transnational kind of level.
Can't agree with you more. I enjoy so much the conversation, and it happened what we believed. We talked about chapter number one, guys. But chapter number one is so important because it's a change of mindset, right? We're gonna definitely need to talk about the Black Swan, also a book in the future, Tom. But just to finish everything we talked about, I'm gonna go back to how we started. With the definition of the black box thinking for those guys who entered, you know, later, we are discussing one book that basically does a very interesting analogy between airplane industry and healthcare, the healthcare organization. And it says that a black box thinking is the willingness and tenacity to investigate the lessons that often exist when we fail, but which we rarely exploit. Why? Because our mindset, because we're afraid of what's going to happen, what they're going to say. And to do that, we need to create a culture with the correct mindset and a system that I hope we can work a lot with that, Tom, in the future, and with so many colleagues around the world who are willing to start talking about this, about system to learn from failure. You know, we need to change our mindset to resilience 110%, right? Failure is just an opportunity to learn. We don't need to be threatened by it anymore.
Exactly. And it's these cultural elements that are really going to improve surgery and surgical outcomes. And you know as well as I do, it's not just about the outcomes for the patient. It's about your day-to-day life. When you're operating well and having good outcomes, it's much better than when you are out there not feeling confident in your surgery in an environment where if you have a complication that it's a problem with yourself and that you need to hide it from people. We should all embrace this open culture, discussion of failure, so that juniors and seniors can get together and say, let's all learn from each other so we all don't need to make the same mistakes. One person globally can make that one mistake and we can all learn from it.
Amazing. And I hope I'm so happy to do this with you. I thank you for your time. And I hope this is the first of many talks about amazing concepts, amazing books. And we're joining, you know, two very far away parts of this planet, right?
Exactly.
It was great to have you, Tom. So hope
well, thanks a lot for that, Eva.
Let's make it happen. I will say next week or maybe in 2 weeks, okay?
Yeah, fantastic.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
See you later.